My name's Long John Neville.
I'm Candy Jones.
And tonight we're going to be talking with Gene Shepherd, well-known humorist, broadcaster, actor, and author of several books and screenplays and numerous articles. And his book that we talked about some time ago, when it was in hardcover, is now in paperback, and it's titled Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters. It's just been published in paperback by Dell Books. Well, Mr. Shepherd, we're delighted to have you here tonight.
Delighted to be here, Mr. Neville, Miss Jones.
How do you do?
I mean, I like John's. He always comes on with that patina of formalism, which gives a certain style to life.
You know, I've never seen Jane before.
Really?
No, I've been a fan.
Disappointing, isn't it, though?
Yeah.
You'd figure he would be a handsome a man.
Evil.
Young.
Yeah, evil he is. He has that evil sort of look. From the left side, I'm viewing him three-quarters left.
He's viewing me from the left side, fourth side.
That's right.
Switch, Jerry.
Well, I'm glad to be here, John. You're looking great.
I'm feeling marvelous. And how are all of the people over at the zoo?
Which zoo? I'm involved at so many zoos, I couldn't tell you. Remember, I'm an associate editor of Playboy, too.
That's right.
I've seen plenty of zoos in my time.
That's right. We were in Cheers last night, and for a moment it was very dark where the gentleman was sitting at the end of the bar, and I didn't realize it was Herb Salzman till after I got into the car. Man said, "Hi, John, how are you?" And I said, "Hi, how are you? Nice to see you." And I didn't realize it was the great Herb Salzman.
You mean that mustache got you?
Yeah.
Well, that just clips on, you know, on his nose. That's not...
He just uses it for bar sitting?
That's right. When he's in the neighborhood there.
But he really is the top maven over there.
Top dog.
Do I write that as a personal attack?
Yes.
But he gets equal time.
We'll have to give him equal time at some time.
Now, Herb's a good guy. He's one of those unusual program heads, chiefs of radio stations. He is
the head man there.
You bet he is. He walks a quiet step down the hall now, though.
And George Brown is what?
George's the vice president. He's in charge of all news for all of RKO General. That's nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great empire, you know, that news they have over there.
Yeah.
So he's doing well.
And then we have Mr. Farber.
Mr. Farber is on the air 4,922 hours a week.
That's right.
At least. And I see Barry occasionally looking harassed in the elevator. He comes popping out. He always reminds me of the jolly green giant that went down and got a suit at Robert Hall. He comes popping out looking frantic. Half the time he says, "Hello, hello," you know, and he grabs your hand, and then about 30 seconds later, throws into his head who he's talking to. Good old Barry.
Is he still counting his money?
I don't know. Barry plays a close hand, as W.C. Fields used to say. He plays a close hand, and it's hard to know.
Yes, it is rather difficult.
I think he's doing well, though, John.
I know he has two penthouses.
Yes, he has.
And so things are going evidently extremely well for him.
Swimmingly.
That's right. I know that foundation that he set up, the Barry Farber Foundation for Wife and Children, I thought was very good, and I know that he'll help many people with that money.
Mm.
Yes.
Mm.
I have not had the opportunity of seeing him for a long time. Did you want to? Oh, you have coffee.
I have coffee, yes. This is a typical radio station coffee.
What do you mean?
It's what my assistant Lee Brown calls rat coffee. Oh, no, wait a minute, Candy. It's perfect for drinking out of paper cups.
These are not paper cups. These are all ceramic lined.
Yeah, I see that. No, it's good.
There's just a little left over from Barry Gray's show. I always take the remains from his show and mix them with
You know what I mean?
You're doing a garlic-like coffee that I can chew. just gives me something to bite on here.
You know, I was just the other day talking to somebody. Oh, I know who it was. It was to one of our spiritual leaders here, Cliff Barrett, our program director. Mm. And he had asked me how, you know, I had started at WR, and I was telling him the story of driving out the first night to the transmitter after you were relieved of your duties at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I went out the next night, and it was very stimulating to have that opportunity of being around with some of the great engineers in broadcasting. I didn't really meet them till about 4 or 5 in the morning when they were awakened.
You know, it was a very interesting time, although I don't think a lot of people at the time, just like any time, you don't have as much of a sense of perspective. But I think that was the period of all the beginning of a lot of the demonstrations in the country and hip humor. For those of you who are listening, Mr. Neville is now posing for what looks like a Gilbert Stuart portrait. And he's doing his American Gothic face, which he learned on the south side of Chicago.
That's quite true. And in a moment, I'm going to tell this young man about the merits of old world herb tea.
You have that look, John.
We have him on his knees already.
That's right.
John is going to come back in another life. He's going to come back as a lady wearing tennis shoes and wearing a Barry Goldwater T-shirt and loving cats.
And Miller for vice president.
You know, it's funny about John. John is one of the few guys I know who get a tremor of true emotion in his voice when he's describing a million tiny invisible fingers moving up and down your back.
gently kneading
your spine.
In every muscle in your body.
And every ganglia is vibrating with excitement. And so he's not like those pillows with a buzzer in them. I'd love to get one of those pillows with a buzzer in it.
This is not a vibrator.
Certainly is a
cyclo action.
Of course, it's like riding downhill in the barrel of an Niagara Falls.
You know what I think about you?
Yeah, Candy.
I always
don't say that on the air. We're on the air. We're off the air. You can tell them the truth.
For some reason, I always associate you with wax teeth.
Wax teeth?
Yeah. Orphan Annie, Little Orphan Annie, Secret Society. And I think we sort of go back to the same time in the 30s. And I read a book of yours one time in which you had said something about your Orphan Annie Secret Society ring. And I think you may have been wrong, or maybe there were two of them. It seems that I was green for years from wearing my Dick Tracy decoder ring.
Well, you see, Candy, when I write or tell a story, I'm not recounting my own past. I have to break this to you gently.
This wasn't you?
No, I'm a storyteller, and a storyteller. No, I have to be honest with you that a lot of people listen to me, and they hear the fact that I use the first person. And they assume that what I'm doing is telling about me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reasonable, you know, assumption. But actually, I work as a comic, really, in the same way that, say, Bill Cosby does. And you hear Bill Cosby tell about stories of Fat Albert, and he says, I was playing around it. Now, he's not really being literal, you know, that he's telling a story. And, in fact, they even got into such a hassle one time on that show that they have to now say before his show, his fictional friends, Fat Albert.
Really?
Yeah, because there were people writing in all the time saying, look, I'm Fat Albert, and I don't like what you said about me last week. And you'll notice that in all my work, for example, the book you're talking about, which is In God We Trust,
All Others Say Cat.
Well, yeah. In the beginning, I very clearly state that it's fictional. And that wasn't for legal purposes. It is fiction.
Mm-hmm. That's very disappointing.
Don't you know the wax teeth? You see, they're still around.
One of the great myths in American life, Candy, and this is, I guess, the problem of growing up in America, because we tend to leave our hometowns when we grow up. We tend to move into different areas. Now, like here, you're living right in the middle of New York City, and I'm sure when you were a kid, you were living in a different area, different
coal
people.
Mine.
Exactly. Okay. Well, What we do, when we grow up and leave that area, we tend to think all that stopped now. We tend to believe that since we're not there, it no longer exists. It's like a guy who, you know, thinks that there isn't Cracker Jack anymore because he's taken up scotch. And he's always shocked to see it's around yet. In fact, it's a funny thing, Candy. I constantly run into this, but the people who are adults who read a book, they tend to read it through their own eyes, of course, which is, again, natural. You should really read it more with an eye towards what the book's trying to say rather than your own involvement with it. And they tend to think that anybody who's read my work, from a kid of 9 years old to a person of 90, that I am specifically writing about his time.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Now, that's important to remember. What I'm saying here is that the things I write about, I'm very careful. I never specify any time in any of my work. I never say it was 1956 or 1942 or 1910 or 1890. But everybody who reads it says, well, it must be my time. Because the things that I write about are things which I think most writers never touch. And that's the day-by-day, almost continuing life of America. For example, just yesterday, I was in an office in Fort Lauderdale talking to a critic.
Yesterday?
Yes.
I mean, for real?
Just flew in this morning, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to this critic who wanted to interview me about Wanda Hickey.
Gee, you'll go anywhere.
Well, I was down there on other business, but he called me. Anyway, the guy says, he's sitting in this office, and strangely enough, there were about 15 secretaries sitting around typing away, see? And they were all about 18 or 19, see? So he says, very pedantic, he says, I don't quite understand this reference that you make here to something called a Twinkie. And I says, a Twinkie? You know what a Twinkie is? He says, well, isn't that some kind of a... an hors d'oeuvre or something like that? I says, my God, with that, all 19-year-old secretaries in the room flipped. And I says, how many of you have gone through a stage when you had a Twinkie hang up? And all of them laughed. And, of course, the point being here that right now there's a 9-year-old kid sneaking out into the kitchen somewhere over in Bergenfield trying to get the last banana Twinkie.
And it's true.
So there are things which in our life, American life, and I'm trying to do, in a sense, what Twain did, really, and I'm not certainly paralleling myself with him, but I'm trying to catalog the daily trials and tribulation of life of the average walking around resident of the 20th century, not a specific period in time.
You sound as though you are today's Mark Twain.
Well, that's a pretty broad statement, because
you're a pretty broad man,
aren't you? No, go ahead. Well, I think Twain. The only parallel I would say is that we use boyhood as a medium, really.
Yeah. You both have sort of your Peck's bad boy syndrome, and you both have your fat kid, your Alfie, and your Butch, and the one who's always the loser, and the one who's always the winner, and the nice kid, and then there's always Aunt Polly. She's always
I think this is a natural, I suppose you might say, distribution of our species. You go right here into the sales department here at WMCA, and you're going to find your Alfie. You're going to find your loser. You're going to find your
loser. Just a moment, Jeff.
Just a moment.
No, when you're talking about our sales department, our spiritual leader happens to be Jerry Lewis. We have some of the finest salesmen in the entire nation associated with this station.
I'm sure.
And I'm proud of being a member of this group.
Of course. And, of course, within them, like all philosophers, I have to say, all present company exempted from any statements here tonight, that none of these things exist here. However, in other areas of life, you will find losers. You'll find winners.
Mm-hmm.
And the relationship between the two is always interesting because they coexist. Winners cannot exist without losers. No way. You cannot be a winner unless there's a loser. And, of course, on the other hand, some people enjoy losing. It's an exquisite thrill to lose. Oh, sure.
Are these the masochists of love?
Not at all.
No. What thrill would there be in losing?
Well, losing gives a person a sense of righteousness often. We have developed a curious, I suppose, say, attitude in America that losers by nature are sort of they're right. In other words, Billy the Kid has become a righteous person. The lawman who gets him is not. In short, the loser is often in America glorified. And so many people like the feeling of losing. It makes them feel as though somehow they had too much to offer. How many times have you heard people say, they weren't ready for it.
Sort of an Al Lachman.
They weren't ready for my truth.
You know, the worst loser.
Unfortunately, they were ready for it, and they caught it on the first bounce, and out he goes. Yeah, go ahead.
The worst loser is the one who comes in second, don't you think? I mean, that's the one I feel is sorriest for.
Yeah, well,
the last one.
He is. He's a true loser.
Yeah.
A true loss is to see, just see flashingly ahead of you the glimmering golden shimmering wings of victory, and then to see somebody who looks a little like John Lindsay grab at the last instant and go off into the dusk.
On a white horse.
Well, you know, and there you are. You're usually in an outboard motorboat with 115 horses.
And we are back here again. My name, Long John Neville.
I'm Candy Jones.
And we're talking with Gene Shepherd, and incidentally, his book is now in paperback, Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters. And Mr. Shepherd is four-time winner of the Playboy Humor Satire Award. And Gene and I have known each other now for about 20 years at that time. He was playing bass for East Side, wasn't it? What was the name of that show?
Drive East.
Drive East.
I really did play bass.
I know it.
Yeah.
I know it.
Incidentally, John, you know, I'm really excited. You know, both of us here are in the business, and it sort of sucks your life in, and you tend to live day by day in it. And I wondered how many people who are outside of the business that we're in, entertainment and performing and all, realize how every day that comes on, you never know what's about to happen.
Well, don't you think it's every other day that really counts when you have your contract renewed for another 48 hours?
See, I don't think that in terms of my show at all, because I guess this is the difference for me than most of other people that I know within this business, let's take radio, is that I'm never concerned whether my show is going to be renewed or anything like that, because I'm doing all these other things, and as a matter of fact, I wish someday I would wake up and magically all of radio's disappeared, and I would start doing the things I should do, which is write more, perform more. Radio's kind of a soporific, at least in my world. In other words, it's a thing that comes very easily to me, and I really shouldn't do it.
Because it's easy to you?
Yeah. And also, it tends to keep me from doing what I should do. It takes a lot of time away, say, from my writing. Now, also, my performing, you know, and I came to town, John remembers, I was doing a lot of acting, I performed in a lot of Broadway
Asylum
shows.
In particular.
Yeah, The Asylum.
That
you said
I remember.
It.
Marvel.
Yep, that's right. Did you see it?
Yes.
You're one of the people who did, too, because that
Second
was...
Second night, excuse me.
That was a brilliant piece of theater. It really was.
Arthur...
Culpit.
Culpit, right.
He wrote Oh Dad, Poor Dad.
Mm-hmm.
It was done at the Theatre de Lys, and it was a production by, it was Roger Stevens produced it. And that show had a curious history. We played for 4 weeks down there. And if you recall, I had the lead in the show, the curious role. And
There were some fantastic people in the cast that were really, in a sense, fit players. For example, Sandy Baron.
Yeah.
He had just a walk-on in that show. Lenny Santoni, you know?
It was somebody else.
George Siegel,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Estelle Parsons was in it.
That's right.
And
that was star-studded.
You better believe it. And you know, that was one of the great I suppose you can call it tragedies in my career, because that never opened. It ran for 4 weeks in previews, and there was something came up with Mr. Copet, I believe, or somebody involved in the production, and decided the night before we would open not to open it. And it was a beautiful production.
We were there, not John, and I was there the second night, and I remember that there was a delay. I don't know why, but it was brilliant. It was
it
one
really
of the
was.
Best things, and Martin Gottfried was in the audience.
Uh-huh.
And he had missed the opening night. And Martin Gottfried is the drama critic from Women's Wear Daily.
Yeah.
And I remember he gave it a great write-up.
That's right.
And you in particular.
Well, I played a curious role in that, if you remember, Candy. I played an ex-Chicago White Sox third baseman.
It was weird.
Yeah, he was a third baseman, and he had played in Comiskey Park, by the way, John.
Southside.
Yeah, and he played against the Yankees, and one day in his rookie year, he was leading the league in hitting, the character, and he was, you know, a pretty sensational rookie. And he got hit by a line drive. You recall the play?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He got hit by a line drive. He played third base, and it ended his career instantly. And here he was now back, and he's in an asylum now. And nobody believes that he actually did this. Was the essence of the play.
It was very sad.
Yeah, they didn't believe it. He kept saying, well, look, all you have to do is read it in the records. Pick up the record book, and nobody would do it.
And they just thought he was a nut, automatically.
Yeah, because he...
What was that, about 64?
65. And I used to... This is getting back to radio now. I used to do a lot of acting, and I was very serious. And well, this is serious theater. As you know, this was not small-time theater. I had done the Broadway revival of Voice of the Turtle. I played the sergeant in that.
Oh.
I did a couple of musicals. I did Destry.
You were in Destry?
Yeah.
Who?
I played Destry. And I did a lot of...
In the original cast?
No, I came, it was revived, and I played it then.
Who was the girl, Gwen Burden?
No, Andy Griffith played Dolores Gray was the
original girl. Dolores Gray was the original
girl,
that's right.
And I did a lot of acting at that time. That was back in the mid-60s. And I'm sorry I didn't stick with it now. In fact, I think I may go back into it because I loved it. And it's really what I am. I'm a performer. When I'm on the air, you know, I'm a performer. I'm playing a role on the air. You know, I do different voices, John, and characters, and I set up scenes and all this. And I've developed almost, I suppose you could say, kind of a one-man epic theater or something. But
How long do you prepare? And do you prepare each night?
A show? Well, my preparing is very private. It's a private thing I do. The people who work with me, for example, Lee Brown has worked with me now for 10 years, and Lee doesn't know what I'm going to do the night I do it. But I will prepare a show in my head sometimes as long as a month when I think about it. And I always have 3 or 4 shows that I'm preparing in my head. I have little notes. As John knows, I have a desk that's just covered with stuff, but that I always know 3 or 4 ideas that I've got, germs of ideas for shows that I work on and prepare. Sometimes I may just do a show that I'll get an idea that afternoon and I'll do it, but that's rather unusual. Usually I prepare anywhere from 2 weeks to maybe 3 or 4 weeks on each show, although it doesn't sound that way.
Mm-hmm.
See,
that's the beauty of it.
Well, you know, Candy, I've always felt, I'm a member of the Actors Studio. When I first came to town, I got on with Bob, as I said, in acting, and I'd gone to Goodman Theater It's a theater school in the Midwest. And I've been doing a lot of improvisational theater. And that kind of acting is a different kind of acting than Americans are used to. Oddly enough, it's the kind of acting Americans do best, too, which is, in a sense, an improvisational kind of acting upon a theme. Dustin Hoffman, for example, is an example of that. He may do a scene seven different ways before they decide which one they're going to take.
Mm-hmm.
He's improvising, but very within a very set limit. And so this is the kind of performing I do on the air. I also, my best evenings are when I'm performing on stage. I did, for example, last spring, I had a big success at Carnegie Hall. We had a sellout there. That's very unusual. In fact, the director, the manager of Carnegie Hall, said that we were the first single comedy act to sell out in a long time. And we sold out. And when I perform on stage, I perform, that is, in the ideal situation, unless I'm playing a college, you can't do that, but in an ideal theatrical situation, I use lights, I use all kinds of area lighting. You remember the area lighting we had in
Asylum? Yeah.
No.
Beautiful. It was a really remarkable,
magnificent performance.
That could be brought back today, don't you think?
I think it was so far ahead of its time, I think they chickened out. I honestly think that was the reason they didn't open it. They were afraid, because it was truly avant-garde theater and beautifully done.
Yeah.
And, of course, that was back in the days when they were doing things like Virginia Woolf, which was very conventional compared to this. And it was a pretty wild piece of theater.
Yeah. Pioneers are losers many times.
That's correct. In fact, George Siegel, the night George and I are close friends, and the night that we were told that show was to open on a Saturday night, and on that Friday night, we had finished a performance, and Cheryl Crawford came backstage, and she just said it was fantastic, and you know who she is, of course, and. All the Actors Studio was coming down there to see it, and we went back to George's house. He has an apartment up on Central Park West, and I went back up to the apartment with George about 1 o'clock in the morning when the phone rang, and it was from the girl who was the production chief for Roger Stevens. And she got me on the phone. She says she knew I was up at George's place, and she says, Gene, she says, you better sit down. I said, what's up? She said, you'll never believe what happened. I said, what? She says, they've decided not to open the show. This was the night of the opening. And we had rehearsed it for 2 months. Very difficult piece of theater. And there's no feeling like that. And I guess this is what really kind of soured me on the theater, because I can't describe what an actor goes through preparing for a role like that. George and myself, we would work on that thing night after night in his house and on the street, and it was a fantastic emotional experience. And then to have somebody arbitrarily say, forget it. And we're sitting around in the apartment. George got up. I'll never forget it. George got up, and he looked down at the floor. Now, George had been in New York for about 8 years without even earning a living as an actor. He was really struggling. And he just walked around, and he walked over, and he kicked the sofa. They had a sofa there. He just kicked a hole right in that sofa. Just kicked it, and he sat down, and his wife came in, and she had coffee for him, and cream cheese, you know, or cheesecake. And she came in, and she looked at us, and she said, what happened? She didn't know what had happened, see? And George says, nothing. And she says, well, there's something happening here in this room. That's what's going on. George says, don't talk. Let's go out in the kitchen and leave us alone for a while. I mean, it was a fantastic shot. So with that, she walked out and went into the kitchen, and about 10 minutes later, we were sufficiently back in the world to realize what had happened. And that following Monday, I got a call from Audrey Wood. Fascinating call. Who was Arthur Copas' agent, incidentally, also.
Voice of Detroit.
Fantastic woman. She was, she's Tennessee Williams' agent, famous lady. And she called me. I never met her before. She called me up to her office, and she said, I just want to tell you, she said, how sorry I am about this. And she says, that was one of the most, she said, I want you to know that had that opened, you probably would have been the hottest actor on Broadway.
How much will it cost to bring that back, bring it in today?
That's a good question. That was an expensive production then, because it was, they had a special stage built. You recall, it was a canted stage.
That's right.
It was a canted stage.
I'd never seen anything like that.
It was really quite a brilliant thing, John. And she went, you know, we've never talked about these things, John, you and I. And I'm glad we're talking about it. You know, it's one of those things I kind of buried in my past and never mentioned. But they went for curious authenticity so much in that production that they even went to the extent of calling the Chicago White Sox and getting an actual Chicago White Sox team warm-up jacket. And the White Sox contributed. Do you remember the jacket I had on the thing?
Yeah.
Curiously enough, that was a jacket. I got this jacket. It had been used, you know. It was actually used by the White Sox that earlier that season. And I got the thing, and I immediately knew whose jacket it was. You could smell it. It smelled like tobacco juice. And it was Nellie Fox, who was the second baseman for the White Sox. It had a two on the side, you know, big two on the back. And it was funny to take that jacket that you could smell that this guy had used this jacket for 2 years and had little pieces. He was a famous tobacco chewer. Little bits of tobacco in the pockets, you know, this major league jacket, really. And I remember sitting on the stage one night, and we were in the middle of a scene. And George and I used to improvise a lot. That's why we got the roles, because we were improvisational actors. George had been with the Premise. Remember the theater, little theater group downtown? That there was an improv group, Theater Flickers group. Remember that?
Noel Baines?
No, Noel just managed the theater where they were.
He was at what it was?
He didn't have the group. But anyway, that one night, George said to me, we're sitting there, see, and we started it. We actually went off the script. George is sitting there. He played a psychiatrist, you recall. Mm-hmm. And he's looking at me, saying he would go into this phony accent, which was part of the thing. Remember, he said, well, I want to tell you. He said, well, that is a very interesting story. And he looks at me, and all of a sudden, he sniffs, and he can smell the tobacco juice. He says, that is a very interesting jacket you are wearing. He says, is that nail pouch you are chewing? And the two of us improvised the entire scene about the kind of chewing tobacco that I chewed when I played ball in the play. And that was written into the script then. It was such a successful moment in the play when everybody started to laugh because they could see this ball player chewing tobacco and spitting all over his jacket. And as you know, I haven't talked about that production. It's been a long time, Candy. I'm glad you brought it up. You're one of the few people I might have seen it.
Well, I often wondered what had happened and why.
So did we.
Well,
this is wonderful. I'm glad you brought it up. I just feel good talking about it.
My name, Long John Neville.
And I'm Candy Jones.
And this is WMCA Dialogue Radio 57, right here in New York City. And we're talking this morning with Gene Shepherd. And his book, which I personally recommend to you, is now available. It's published by Dell in paperback for $1.25. Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters. And Mr. Shepherd is 4-time winner of the Playboy Humor and Satire Award. And Candy and I are talking to him. Just at the time when we had to take care of some business, which we're delighted to take care of business, you were going to say something, Gene.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how are those horses out of Downeytown Inn?
Well, I am not a horseman. Mr. Gray is an expert horseman.
Excellent rider.
Mr. Strauss is a horseman. And Candy.
Do they have good horses out there?
I don't know, but I did see the stable. I wasn't inside. We had a tour all around by Mr. Tavis. And the stable looked very good in the few horses I saw.
Is there a good riding area around?
Oh,
it?
Absolutely marvelous.
Well, they can keep the skis, right?
Well, the countryside is beautiful. It's slopy, and the bridle trails are beautiful. And you'd like it if
now,
you...
I'd like
you
to
ride English? Or?
Yeah, well, I like both, English and Western.
Yeah, well, whatever. They have both.
Whatever's around, you know, if you have an Appaloosa, you ride Western. But I love
riding.
That's
strange that you ride both.
Why?
Well, most people I know, if you ride English, you ride English, period. But, you don't usually ride Western.
What do they do when they suddenly are given a quarter horse to ride?
I don't think that they ride.
Oh, I'm sorry for them.
Well, probably, but it's an odd thing. I don't know why they don't, but I've known very few people who have ridden.
Well, I guess that's because I had a kind of an eclectic riding background, right? If you come from a orthodox family, you'll learn to ride English, you know. Or if you come from a some family in New Mexico or something, you'll ride Western. But I went with whatever happened to be going around at the time, and I learned what English riding I know from. I was, motivation is important in your life.
Yeah.
And there was one period in my life when I was really hung on this girl. And she was a fanatical rider. Mm. And I mean, a good one. In fact, she was so good. You remember when they had those camel ads? They had the T-zone. They said the X.
Oh, yes,
said,
yeah.
Okay. Well, she was that good that she was in one of those ads.
Oh.
She was a famous steeplechase rider. And I had been faking. Yes, very good. And I had been faking it since. And so finally, the inevitable happened. One time, she got me out. She says, well, we've got to go riding. And I said, all right. And all right. And I'll never forget that look of that horse. The horse turned around, gave me one look. And the horse has a fantastic extrasensory perception. And this horse instantly senses a person that he can master totally. And he turned around and just gave me that mean look in his eyes. She says, I can't understand what's the matter with him. He's usually very nice.
Your knees, and you know it.
That's right. It's the only horse I've ever ridden that as I rode him, he kept biting my knee. Incidentally,
yeah.
Full stride.
Lula Shepherd asked a question, and I can't answer it.
Yeah.
And I've never known myself. What is English?
Or what is English riding?
And what is Western?
Well, it's a very different kind of riding.
Is it a different saddle, too?
Yeah.
Yes. Different saddle, different seat.
And the gates are different?
The gates are different.
Oh, you mean the horse is different?
Yes. Yes.
The gates
are
different.
Oh. I thought you just changed the saddle.
Let's put it this way. English is very uncomfortable, and Western isn't.
Well, if you're in a McCallum saddle for too long a time, you can get awfully tired. I know that the old cowboys used to ride in them, and that's the saddle with the pommel up in the front. But
what do you call it?
McCallum.
No, I mean the thing.
The pommel.
It's a pommel.
But the English saddle, I always found far more comfortable, but I think it's all with which you start. I was brought up in an English saddle, but we had McCallum.
Well, I was a bareback rider, primarily.
Were you?
Yes.
Well, I think all kids
do
that.
Some people learn to ride bears pretty well.
That's a grizzly one.
Very good there. Shep, and I didn't think I was feeding you a line, but I did accidentally.
It's sneakier as time goes, but English riding, John, if you're asking a serious question, is more formal. And it's not working riding, really, in the sense that Western riding. Western riding is working riding. It's a, I suppose you can call it a riding for a work purpose.
What am I wearing?
Well, she's got the split English coat. Yeah.
I've got a hacking jacket.
Hacking jacket, yeah, that's what I thought. I'd have to see the front, though. It is a hacking jacket, yeah, sure.
You know why it's a hacking jacket?
I don't know if you'd be interested in that, Chuck.
Well, go ahead, explain.
But one of the reasons is that if you notice the length of this jacket, now when you're just hacking around, and this is what the phrase hacking around
is. Yeah, hacking means just riding.
You're just riding.
Just
you're
out
not,
riding for fun.
You're not riding for points, you're riding casually. So that the length of the jacket hides your backside, your rump on the seat, and you do not necessarily, you're not positioning or posting formally. You're not riding for, you're riding in a relaxed for enjoyment. So that a hacking jacket will always be longer and it will flap a bit on the seat.
It's a casual jacket for casual riding,
right.
English riding. And
whereas when you're showing, your jacket is going to be shorter because you'll be judged on points as to what your derriere is doing.
They judge your seat, as they call
your
it.
Your seat, right.
Well, Princess Anne is a fantastic rider.
I've seen films of her. She really is so great.
Yeah. They claim that if she wasn't a member of the royal family, she would really be an international rider. But she is.
Highly competitive, isn't she?
Very. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's got the look in the eye, yeah. Kathy Kushner, that type.
Did you know that Barry Gray is now a mounted policeman? Theatrical district?
No kidding.
Yes, looks absolutely magnificent in his uniform. And, of course, he is considered to be an outstanding
rider, yes.
And so is our president.
Well, how did he get this?
Peter Strauss.
Has he got the power of arrest?
Yes.
Well, Barry is an appointed
He's an
police.
Auxiliary mounted policeman.
Troop B.
He's a mounted trooper.
Yeah, they have two or three. They have three troops, don't they? A, B, and C, or is it just two?
This I don't know, but Michael Burke, Vincent Sardi, Barry Gray.
Very
a
elegant.
Lot of people.
Very elegant.
And we saw him in his uniform. He went to Remount School, and he's enjoying every minute of it. And he said...
You know, all right, I'll ask you a question now. You're a horseman. What kind of horses does the New York City police use? Come on, what are they?
I know.
They're great horses.
I know, and I can't tell
you. And they're a specific breed. What
yes,
are they?
They are, and I cannot tell you.
Morgans.
Morgans.
Yeah. The Morgan is a New England horse, by the way, that was bred, I guess, just before the Revolution. It began by a man named Morgan. And they claim that, no, Paul Revere's horse was not a Morgan. What kind was it?
I wouldn't know.
Well, I'm going to leave
Paul
that
Revere would have been in the 18th century.
This week, and we'll ask him.
That's right.
Well, this was, the Revolution was...
They know what type of horse he had. In other words, he had a specific breed that he rode.
Yeah.
It was a popular breed at that time.
Say, do you know about this island off the coast? I don't know. Do you mind if I just...
Don't talk over here.
off the coast of Virginia.
Yeah.
And Maryland, where they have the horses.
The wild... Yeah.
Yeah, they're not full-size horses.
Oh, they're really wild. Very definitely wild. Yeah.
But they are wild, and... I haven't read anything yet this year, but I know every year I read where
What's
they...
What's the name of those ponies? They're named after that island.
Yeah, I know. I thought you'd know.
Starts with a C. Chincoteague?
Chichester?
Chincoteague.
It's a strange...
Strange
it's,
Indian
yeah.
name. But there are wild horses off the coast of Virginia. Yeah.
And they drop... helicopters go over in bad weather when possibly they cannot get anything to eat, and they save the lives of all of them. And a few of them have been brought back, and they have been able to tame a few of them.
Yes.
Do you ever ride a polo pony, by the way?
Listen, you know, it's funny. We were talking about polo. I did a show on polo the other night. We got on the subject of sports, and I think sports are really getting bigger and bigger in American life. And I thought my own personal favorite spectator sport, of course everybody would think automatically would be hockey or pro football or baseball. Actually, I don't think there's anything more exciting than a game of polo. You ever seen polo played by experts? It's fantastic.
Do you want to know who is one of the greatest polo players around in this city? And I used to see him on Friday nights right across from where I where I used to live.
Where do you play out of Long Island?
Mayor Lindsay. Ex-Mayor Lindsay.
Lindsay
was a marvelous polo player.
Yes. Yeah.
And you know, it's now a school, and this is up at 94th and Park. It used to be an armory, and they used to have polo matches in there on Friday nights. Now it is a school.
Well, isn't that some fantastic sport to watch?
Oh, absolutely.
Beautiful. And you talk about a sport that it takes guts to play, John.
Yeah.
You see a guy come barreling down that field on a polo pony, going full out with five others coming in at him. It's something.
Yeah. Great courage.
Great courage and fantastic skill. You have to. They ride. Of course, you know those polo ponies are mostly aren't they little South American horses?
They're smaller than the average horse. And they turn on a dime, and when you say you ride with your knees, all you need to do is have a slight twitch in your leg,
yeah,
and you are spinning around.
And the really good polo ponies will follow the ball. They're really more competitive often than their riders.
Gene, you might appreciate this, and I'll get off horses because I'm sorry, I don't know how we got onto it, but when I was a pre-teenager, I think an awful lot of girls have always loved horses. I don't know why girls, but there's been all the girls I knew when I was growing up. We all went riding. And we went, you know, there were certain things you do. You'd go to dancing school and you'd take riding lessons and so forth. Well, I didn't have riding lessons, but I went riding with the kids. I'd get on my bike and I'd go over. But I could only go once a week. And this goes back to the 30s. And even then, it was a very expensive thing. It cost $5, and that was a lot of money. But to be able to get free rides, they had polo ponies over in the armory in a place called Kingston. So I got my free rides in because I would exercise the polo ponies. And that's how I got my freebie riding in.
But what great horses to exercise, you know? You know, those polo ponies, if I may, one of the greatest kicks I had in my performing career, John, is a few years back. Do you remember when John Chancellor was doing the Today Show?
Yes, I do.
Well, I was, at one time, I was on the Today Show as a regular. I had, in a sense, the Joe Garagiola role. And we traveled around the country. Al Morgan was the producer of the show then. And Louise King was the girl at that point. She was the Barbara Walters in that period. And we went down to the Fort Worth cattle auction. Did the whole show there for a whole week. And I was the only one of the three who really could ride Western. Louise rode English. And John rode merry-go-round horses. Badly. So I was the one that did all the riding. So I had some fantastic moments. We went on this cattle ranch. Actually, it was a quarter horse ranch between Dallas and Fort Worth, a famous ranch called the Phillips Ranch. And they had the greatest quarter horse. In fact, they had world champion quarter. It had Eccles, Jim Eccles there. Was a great, at that time, national champion quarter horse. And they had the three-time winner of the national cutting quarter horse. Have you ever seen a cutting quarter horse?
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. And he said, you want to go out on him? And I said, sure. So here was this $250,000 quarter horse. You know, I get on this baby, and we start walking out. And this horse, it was like... it's hard to express it. He was like an extension of your own mind. And so this champion rider said, I'm going to give a demonstration. We did it on television. This horse had not done any cutting for like a year at that point. He was at stud. See, so they took him out into this corral, and they let these calves go, and they cut a calf for us. And in the first moment he cut this calf, unbelievable, he broke the world's record, this horse.
Mm.
It would be like if you haven't skied in 2 years, and then you go out and you break the world record. And, fantastic horses. And so.
And you rode one?
Oh, yeah. In fact, that afternoon, then, we shot another sequence. We went out to the, down in Texas, they really do it. There's some awfully expensive horse flesh. And so we went to this big arena. I don't recall what the show was. It was some big fair they had down there. And they had... the national champion
Arabian stallion, which was owned by a woman. And so they gave me this horse to ride, and it was the national, at that time, the national champ was 1965, and it was black, rare, very rare, a black, pure black Arabian stallion. And we went around, I'm riding around on this baby, we went around the ring, and I'm sitting at this horse, and I thought, my God, you know, this horse is probably worth more in actual dollars, John, as you say, the classical buck, than all the executives in New York radio and television combined. And this race, you know, it's unbelievable, it's a pleasure, you know, the horse that knew he was the chief. And we went in front of the stands with the crowd cheering, and I'm wearing this big 10-gallon hat. You know, I remember an interview I had that afternoon. I was interviewing somebody from this horse. So I'm sitting on this horse, and the camera dollies in. And who I'm interviewing is fascinating. Two 90-year-old cowboys, both sitting on quarter horses, who had been around back in the days of the Texas Rangers when they really did. They were 90 years old. And these two long, skinny guys, one had been national cowboy champion of 1929 or something, and they're both sitting there. And these two guys had these leathery faces, you know, they made Gary Cooper look like a Girl Scout brownie. Sitting there chewing tobacco, and I said to this one guy, and I said, well, I said, you know, when you're with people like that, you tend to fall into the vernacular. You start to talk like one. He says, well, how do you think things are going these days? Everything normal around here? And he looks at me and says, yep. He's looking at that horse. He said, finally, he said to me, he said, is that quite a horse you're riding? I said, yep. He says, yours? At that point, I had to make a choice. I just looked at him and spit, you know. It's your good eye for a horse. He says, yep. And that went all coast to coast. We got millions of letters the next day. This one to Shepherd on the national Arabian champ. But this is funny enough.
You know the difference between a high school horse and a Liberty horse?
A high school horse?
Or a Liberty horse?
And a Liberty horse.
They're used in circuses. And a couple of times I've mentioned this, and people will call and ask me what is the difference or what are they. And I really don't know. But when you go to the big show, you find possibly many types of horses. But the Liberty horses are trained in a certain way. And the high school horses, now whether they're different breeds or not, I do not know. But they are the performing horses. Those, you know, that stand on their hind legs.
Gosh.
But I don't know which. Is, you know, which ones are Liberty or which ones are high school horses.
You mean that's a circus term they use?
No, I don't think it's a circus term. I'm sure they wouldn't just use it in the circus. It must be a horseman's term.
Have you, Candy?
I hadn't, and we had gone over this once before. One of the two is the horse that does dressage, and the other is the horse that just follows. And
that would probably be the high school horse.
Which?
The dressage,
I think. And then the Liberty is the one that just is, he just goes around in the parades, and he just runs around and he follows.
Well, no, I'm not bragging of the parades. I'm talking about working
in the ring.
Center ring.
Yeah.
And, again, I don't know which is Liberty and which is high school, but the ones where they don't really have a saddle on it, they have something. Well, it's bareback, no. And he'll jump, the performer will jump from one to another and then go through the hoops, you know what I mean, with the fire burning and so forth and so on. And they're marvelous horses.
Have a lot of, you know, I think a lot of those horses have Belgian blood, wouldn't you say,
yes.
Candy?
Yes.
The
European horses.
The European horses. A lot of them are Hanoverians.
You know what's happening right now. Gray is out of his bird. He's possibly saying, Now, how in the devil can I get John with my Dixie Cup phone line to tell him the difference of the two? Because I think he told me once, and I didn't, and I really didn't understand the difference.
You know, most circus horses, I think, are European. You're right, Candy, and I think a lot of them are German Hanoverians, those big Hanover.
You know, if Barry was listening, or if he is listening,
that might be
317. No, that's not Barry there. It would be 317. And Barry would understand what that means, I'm sure. 317.
Well, you know Lee Brown, don't you? Who?
Know Lee Brown?
Lee used to be a professional jump rider, Joe.
I didn't know
before
that.
Before she came to me. Yeah, she jumped horses in a lot of the shows, big shows around this area for people. And as Candy knows, that's a tough profession.
It sure is.
And she was hurt in an accident. Horse fell on her, yes, that's right. And she was in the hospital for about a year. That's why she had to give it up. But she used to exercise horses out at Belmont when she was working with me. You might not have known that, but she...
No, I didn't.
6 o'clock in the morning and five and go out there and exercise these thoroughbreds. And, boy...
Did you ever get up to Saratoga?
Isn't that a beautiful place?
That is the most beautiful place. And a very a quickie. I had the great thrill. I was doing a monitor thing up there, and I interviewed, how can I forget his name? He was the greatest race caller of all time. He's retired.
Fred Capistella.
Yes, Capistella.
Oh, hello.
And they're up. And I was up in the booth up there, and it was fascinating the way he used to do the horses. He had nothing more than the program folded, just as anybody would buy the 50-cent program was folded. And he had binoculars. And I had my, I think it was a Mohawk. I had a little, was it a Sony? Possibly a Sony portable.
Well, you started with Mohawk tape.
Yeah, but it was after Mohawk. I had been graduated to something else. But anyway, let's say it was a Sony. And in some way, he was watching, following. This was the big race, and he's following the horses around the Travers. And accidentally, I knocked the program down.
Oh.
And he looks down. He put his glasses down, and this is on the air, too, to tell what horse... Because he knew number six, and he'd look at the program to tell what it was. It had fallen down, and fortunately, he remembered whatever horse it was. But what also happened, I was there 2 days, and they gave me the great thrill of pushing the button over at the far... corner when they were doing... Yeah, I pushed the starter button.
What a...
It was.
What a feeling that was.
And to see that much horse flesh passing, tons and tons of horse flesh, and I was... You know, there's a stand, and you go up this thing, it's almost like a guillotine, and you stand there, and there's a little stick, and there's just a little button on it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a man who does nothing but start the horse races, and he came up with me. And if nothing could happen, of course, and Fred couldn't say, and they're off. And the jocks are all sitting looking at you, and you know...
Those horses are moving.
Yeah, and it's the most thrilling thing.
It
was,
really is.
Yeah, it really was. And I had my tape recorder going, and it was all...
Well, you know, Candy, you brought up a lot of memories, because at that time... we did, speaking of being right in the starting arena there, among other things that we did on that Today show was that they had an exhibition quarter horse race. Now, I don't know, have you ever seen a quarter horse race?
No, I've only seen it on film.
You can't believe it. A quarter horse, John, is the fastest creature in a quarter mile this side of a cannonball. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And they scramble. They don't run like, you know, the thoroughbreds have this long stride. A quarter horse leaps out of the gate. He scurries down there, and they go down in like a pack, like rabbits. Well, I was right down in the starting grid there, and they had six quarter horses. And they were all top money-rated quarter horses. I mean, real record-cut quarter horses in there. Wild. The eyes are rolling and they're looking out at you. And I was standing behind. I wasn't starting. I was watching. And I was describing it. And Chancellor was down at the other end, down at the quarter mile pole where they ended.
Yes.
See? And I saw John down there with his microphone, and the bell went, you know, bang, whoom, there's a roar, and there was a great, fantastic cloud of mud these kicked up. Mud and all kinds of stuff flew back, you know, that you find on racetracks. And it just came flying back. I mean, these horses thundered up, and the thunder was so much, John, that it literally shook us off the air. We had to reshoot the whole thing because they jarred all the equipment. And to get right down on the racetrack and be there when these babies are running, you're right, it's tons.
Yes, yes.
And the horse loves to run. You know how many people don't know this about horses?
Yeah. You know, they think, well, the poor horses out there, and they have to do it. They adore it. They're bred for this.
John, we've been boring you.
No,
you haven't. Flying
glory.
That Barry would call me 317 and would want to tell us the difference between the Liberty horse and the high school horse, because he is really an expert.
Well, you've uncovered a carefully concealed side of Shepherd tonight.
Yes, I never knew this.
Never discussed this, mm-hmm. But...
You still riding a cycle?
Motorcycle? No, I haven't had a cycle here for a couple of years. The last one I had was a Honda 305. It was a racing bike.
Yeah.
And it was a good bike, but the odds began to go up, you know, about two or three years ago. The odds of danger went up. And I just finally said, well, I've had the bikes. I rode them for 8-9 years. That was enough.